on the Vedic administrative system, which is not directly a spiritual topic, but the Krishna consciousness movement is meant to touch all facets of human society. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, which is a concise treatise of spiritual knowledge, refers to the Vedic administrative system, Chatur Varnyang Maya Srishtam Guna Karma Vibhagashaha. He states that the system of four varnas, of four divisions of human society according to occupation, that Krishna says that is created by myself, according to the divisions of quality and work. So it is referred to in Bhagavad Gita, although the topic is principally spiritual, but even Bhagavad Gita is how to live a spiritual life in the material world. So the whole Vedic system is set up for living a spiritual life while going on in this material world. It's interesting I've been asked to speak about this, because here in Britain it may not be directly stated, but it's generally assumed that in this country and in the Western world in general, we've got it all worked out. We have the best system of governance, and we know what's, and we have to go to other countries and bomb them and all this kind of thing just so that they can have the benefits of our civilization. So it's generally assumed like that, that democracy must be the best system. Winston Churchill stated that democracy is a terrible system of governance, but it's the best that we have. Something to that effect. So that I'm being asked to speak on this at all, especially considering it's during the colonial days, which in some ways haven't really ended at all, but that was the stated justification for the British and the Spanish and the Portuguese and the Dutch and others to go to different parts of the world and subjugate them. That was the idea, that we're bringing them civilization. Although actually in India, civilization, if you want to extend the word civilization beyond a phenomenon that can occur in Europe, then civilization had been going on long before even the Romans or the Greeks in Europe. And what to speak of the Vikings and the Huns and the Vandals and the Angles and the Saxons, who weren't that civilized at all. So it's generally thought that, well, here in Britain and America especially, and other countries to some extent, we've got it all worked out, and countries like India, they really have to learn from us. They're really primitive. They're stuck in their ancient, archaic, dysfunctional ways. But if we step back a bit and have a look, Britain's not really an exemplar of all perfection. It's a long way from utopia. Maybe there is something to learn. What is there to learn from India, the administrative system? I shouldn't talk about India administrative system, because then we think about India today, but the ancient administrative system. The present system is something which developed in course of time in Britain, what's called democracy. Of course, the original democracy, as far as we know, is in Greece, but it's not the concept of democracy there. It's not that everyone has a vote. It was just a privileged few. But this system which has developed in Britain and has more or less the same idea as there in much of Europe and much of the world was plonked onto India, which has a very different background. There was a very different idea of governance and polity in India before the British arrived, and it was in many ways similar to that which was accepted all over the world, that there's a king. A king means not someone who, of course, in Britain there's still a queen, and then after her there's supposed to be a king, but not really a monarch at all, just in, for namesake only, but a real king who's in charge. Now, that's, according to a democratic understanding, something seriously wrong there. Why should one person have so much power? Well, to understand this, and I was asked to speak about this, so I try and give some idea for understanding this. To understand this, we have to understand that the basis of Vedic polity is completely different. The whole outlook on life is different. To understand the ancient system of Vedic governance, we have to understand the goal of the society. Now, here in Britain, there's no constitution as such, but in America there is, in which it's stated that it's specifically mentioned the pursuit of happiness. And as America and Britain are sister countries, or rather, America is the younger brother who became a millionaire, and Britain's still the older brother who's not doing so well. So something like that. So it's a very similar culture, outlook, goal of life, and although it's not specifically stated in any constitution in the still United Kingdom, because there is no constitution, but it's understood that the pursuit of happiness is the goal of life. And the pursuit of happiness is understood to mean that everyone should have opportunity to earn money and spend it as they like and enjoy themselves as they like. Or, to put it simply, eat, sleep, drink, be merry and enjoy, for tomorrow we shall all be dead. That's more or less the motto, the unspoken, underlying raison d'etre, or purpose of life in the United Kingdom. The Vedic system of governance is based on a completely different understanding. To begin to understand it, we have to understand the underlying worldview, which begins with understanding the principle of reincarnation. That this life is not the only life. If we think this life is the only life, then eat, sleep, drink, be merry and enjoy, for tomorrow we shall all be dead. Or otherwise you could be a Christian. That was the British culture some time ago. But the idea, there's only one life. But the whole Vedic way of life is based on the understanding that we do not have just this one life. It's just now, and you get born, you don't know where you came from or why you're here, and then you live for some time in the pursuit of happiness, happiness as perceived through the senses, touching, tasting, smelling, feeling, hearing, and all based around the mind. And you go on with your life for some time. You don't know where you came from or what you're doing, and then you die, and that's it. Either, if you're an atheist, you die, and if you believe that it's all finished, there's, or you're a Christian and you believe that you go to heaven. But anyway, it's just one life. That's all. That's the idea. Only one life. Whereas the Vedic understanding, Veda means knowledge. It's accepted as axiomatic. It's not accepted as an opinion. That's another big difference between Vedic society and this society. There's a basis. There's a knowledge basis. So the beginning of that knowledge is to understand that we are all eternal spiritual beings. And we're in a body at the present time. When the body dies, we shall continue to exist. Before this body came into being, I existed. I've got this particular body, born in a particular place, with certain facilities, certain characteristics, because of what I did in previous lives. And we're all on a journey, a multi-life journey. The journey is to the spiritual world. We are meant for purification of consciousness. So that is the purpose of life. There's a clear understanding that the purpose of life is to become purified. That means to become free from base tendencies. Lust, greed, anger, pride, illusion, envy, and so on. And then when we're fully purified, we get free from the cycle of birth and death, which is full of suffering, and go to the spiritual world. So it's a very different outlook. In the Western world, the idea is that, well, you have one life and you try to enjoy it as best you can. And the Vedic outlook is that we have many, many, many births, but the world is not a place for us to be happy in. It's actually a place of suffering. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha doshan udarshanam. One should see that this world is full of misery because there's repeated birth, death, old age, and disease. No one can avoid these as long as we're in this world. So the purpose, there is a set purpose of life for everyone, which is to become free from these tendencies. Beginning with the very idea that we shall try to be happy in this world and enjoy it, in the Vedic understanding, that is the cause of our bondage in this world. So it's completely opposite. In the sense gratificatory, hedonistic society, the idea is enjoy yourself. But in the spiritually advanced society, the idea is, the understanding is that this enjoyment in this world, the more we try to enjoy, the more we suffer. And the more we detach ourselves from the very low level of enjoyment that we have in this world, then we can start to experience the spiritual bliss. Because enjoyment in this world means enjoyment of the touching, tasting, smelling, feeling, hearing. That is sensual enjoyment. The enjoyment of the nose, eyes, ears, tongue, skin, all centered around the mind. But that is on the same level as the pigs and the dogs and the cats, and it's not at all a high level of enjoyment. And actually, if that is our goal, to enjoy sense enjoyment, then we're not in the best body. For instance, if our aim of life is sexual enjoyment, which is very much central to the, well, in any society, but especially it's very much emphasized in the in modern society, we'd be better off in a monkey body. You don't have to go to all this trouble of earning money. You just jump around the forest. Of course, you don't have monkeys here except in the zoos, but in countries like India, there are plenty of monkeys jumping all around, and there's no income tax, and plenty of girlfriends, and no jobs, and no boss, and it's great fun. The only thing is, you're a monkey, and so there's no spiritual advancement in the body of a monkey. And a monkey also has to suffer birth, death, old age, and disease. So the human life is meant for spiritual realization. That is the basic understanding of the Vedic society. But it's also understood that people are at different levels. Not everyone is at a very advanced level of spiritual understanding. So people are placed in different occupations according to their tendencies, guna and karma, the kind of work that they gravitate toward and the kind of qualities that they have. And we find that apart from having different bodies, everyone has a different body, obviously. Some bodies are white, some are blackish, some are brownish, some are yellow, some are tall, some are short, some are fat, some are thin, some are male, some are female. But there are also different kinds of mentalities. Some people are very intellectual. Some people have natural leadership qualities. Sometimes we see there are seminars on leadership, how to become a leader. But you can't become a leader just by going to a seminar. If you don't have the innate qualities, then it's not going to work. You can't make a donkey into a horse by a seminar. You have to have some, basic stuff to work with. So some people, they have that natural tendency. Some people have a natural propensity for making money. Again, you can go to some seminar on how to read all these books on how to make money. And there are some people they can go through. They can go through a dozen courses on how to run a business, and they'll take one loan after another from a bank and lose it all one after the other. And there are others who start with nothing and they've got it in their blood, so to speak, how to make money. And there are other people who are not very capable, and again, if you give them so much education, but even if you try, it's not that you can just make anyone. Say you want to make a child. My child should be a nuclear physicist. But not everyone has it in them to be so. So people are born with certain propensities which they bring from their previous life, and they should be trained and engaged accordingly. That is a basic understanding of Vedic polity. Not that we just try to make everyone all the same. The same education for everyone up to the age of, what is it, 15, 16? What's the minimum? 16. And then afterwards, they still don't know what they're going to do for the rest of their life. And then most of them nowadays go on to university, and the university is not really university, it's what university used to be. And then they try and get some job, and in many cases, whatever they've studied in the university, they get a job in some other profession anyway. So as one of my teachers told me at school here in England, whatever you've learned here in school for the course, you can just forget it as soon as you finish the exam, because it has no relevance to your life afterward. Teacher kindly told me. Very, very inspiring. In fact, he was quite an open-minded man. I don't know what the teachers are like nowadays, because I haven't been to school for the last 40 years or so. But sitting in the class, it was a sociology class, and it was talking about all these fishermen in Hull, Kingston upon Hull, how they go to sea and then they go to, and then they come back and then they get drunk and then they go out to sea again. And I said in the middle of the class, this is all nonsense. What are we doing? Anyway, everyone knows the fishermen, they go and have all these fancy words like anami and all this. And he said, yeah, it's nonsense, but anyway, you have to study it so you can get your A-level or whatever it was. So instead of educating everyone with, at least in my experience, incredibly boring experience at the school, not at all inspiring, people are trained differently according to their propensity, which is to be ascertained at a young age. And not everyone is to be educated, of course, in the way which we perceive nowadays, because, nowadays everyone requires to be educated because we have a very complex technological society, and for instance, to drive a car, you have to be able to read the signs on the road. So everyone requires some level of education to fit in this society, but actually, if someone's going to be, for instance, a factory worker, what do they have to go to school for minimum 11 years? And they end up doing some robotic kind of job. Or they're a taxi driver. Then why is it required that everyone has to go to school? There was some idea that, well, by education, people's character will be improved. Well, that's a failure, isn't it? Everyone has education, but what happened to the improvement of the character? There's no improvement of character. In fact, we can safely say that with each generation, or practically with each year, or with each day, the character of people is getting worse and worse. So, and then that brings into question, what is this whole civilization anyway? You have motorways and technological advancement and so many things, but what is the character of the people? No government should dare to take taxes from the people. If the people cannot walk on the street without fear of being attacked, and if they can't leave their house with the door open, that should be the standard. If you have to put locks on the door, then the government's not doing their job properly. That should be the standard. There should be such an atmosphere that the people are honest. And if there are dishonest people, they should be dealt with, punished so stringently that people won't want to be thieves. There are still places like that in the world where people walk. I remember as in my youth in Ireland, going in villages and you'd come in someone's house and there's no one in the house. The door's wide open, no one in the house. Still in Sri Lanka, there must be places, plenty of places like that. Why? Because no one steals. It wouldn't cross their mind to steal. That should be the standard. Of course, that's less and less everywhere. Nowadays, people want to speak of leaving their house without anything being stolen. They can be afraid in their own house. They don't feel safe in their own house. That anyone can come at any time, and just in America that's more prominent. Violent crime. Some criminals can just come, or the police can come also in America and just in the name of searching your house and just take you out with guns and everything. Of course, we think, well, in Britain we're much more civilized than in America. But whatever's in America, violent crime, it's just Britain's always one generation behind. Your Slovenia is still one of the most civilized countries, it seems. There's not much violent crime there. Anyway, give it a few more years. Because everything is declining. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam, Tatas Chanu Dinam
Tatashchanudinam dharma satyam shocham shamadaya kalena balina rajan nang shantyaya balang smritihi. In Srimad Bhagavatam, it's stated that in this Kali Yuga, the present age in which we live, the age of quarrel and hypocrisy, with the passing of every day, all good qualities will diminish. Beginning with dharma, a word which is sometimes translated as religion, but which in this context means a sense of righteousness, that there is right and there is wrong. So with the passing of every day, a sense of righteousness decreases, truthfulness decreases, cleanliness decreases, tolerance decreases, just like this road rage someone cannot tolerate if they have to wait in a traffic jam, or someone overtakes them and they just can't tolerate, no tolerance of any slight disturbance. People get wild, can do. Daya, compassion for others. One prominent symptom of the modern Western world, and actually it's all over the world, is slaughterhouses. People are very concerned that if humans are killed, but every day millions of, if we take together all the cows, pigs, chickens, fish that are killed, it must be run into millions every day. No mercy. Mercilessly, they're kept in conditions which the animals throughout their life, they're kept in torturous conditions and then just killed. So there's no compassion, no mercy. Then other qualities that, these are just a sample of the qualities that diminish every day. Kalena balena rajan nangsha, lifespan decreases. Bodily strength decreases. Then mental strength decreases. People are getting more and more sick. And despite the education for everyone, but people are getting more and more stupid. In fact, it's perceived that there is the dumbing down of the population. Keep the people stupid, otherwise they won't go on doing what they're doing. That people are stupid is quite apparent from the advertisement industry. They call it an industry, although they don't produce anything. For instance, Coca-Cola. No one would ever buy Coca-Cola if it wasn't advertised, because it has no food value. As far as I remember, it doesn't taste particularly good. But it's a multi-billion dollar industry. Why? Because of advertisement. How can they sell it? Just by some jingly kind of advertisements. It just goes to show that they're playing on people's stupidity. That you can sell all kinds of things. Because people are stupid enough to go along with the idea that if I buy a Coca-Cola, my life will be better. They don't think about it. That's the point. They don't think. So, Vedic society is meant to make people actually intelligent. And particularly, there is the class of intelligent people who guide the society. But they are not the administrators. There are two classes of leaders of society. One is who are called the brahmanas. They are deeply learned in Vedic knowledge about the purpose of life, but they don't personally administrate. Now, if we use this term, some confusion may come because there's the Brahmana class in India today, but that's not who we're talking about. The Brahmana class in India today is by birth only, but not by quality. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, guna karma vibhagashah, that the brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, shudras, the different classes of society, they should be according to their qualities. So if someone is born in a brahmana family and they claim, I'm a brahmana, that is invalid. Just like one's father and mother may be famous doctors, but it's not that the children can claim to, well, I'm also a doctor. They may have a good opportunity to become a doctor because they're raised in that atmosphere, but they have to take the training. Otherwise, they're not qualified to practice as a doctor. They have to be properly trained. So brahmanas, they are trained in spiritual knowledge and they are detached, because someone who's trained in spiritual knowledge is not trying to enjoy this world or dominate this world. They know that the purpose of life is spiritual realization. So they are fit to give advice because they don't have any motive to exploit. Those who actually rule are kshatriyas, kings. They are trained differently. Whereas brahmanas are trained in intellectual pursuits, and they may be priests also. And they may all varieties of knowledge. They will also be the ones who teach the boys who are going to be kshatriyas, kings or military leaders. They teach them how to use weapons, how to fight, how to administer. Famous example in Mahabharata is Drona, Dronacharya, the military guru of both the Pandavas and the Kauravas, who ended up fighting each other. So the kings, they have absolute power, not quite absolute, because they have to be approved by the brahmanas. And if they misuse their power, the brahmanas can dislodge them from their position also. So brahmana, kshatriya, vaishya, their role is as merchants, farmers, bankers. And then there are shudras who are laborers, artisans, musicians, all these different divisions. So it's a very different system. It's not that everyone has an equal voice. In modern democracy, people vote. They don't know what they're voting. How can they understand? I doubt actually if most of the MPs who are in the parliament, if they understand how the economic system works. I doubt if any economists even know. They didn't predict the recent implosion, the financial crash. If they're all so brilliant economists, then they should have been able to predict it, isn't it? But they didn't, it just happened. Some of them knew it was happening, and so some of them knew what was going on. Those who knew what was going on, they got into the banking sphere and made themselves huge fortunes. But most of, by a process which, if it hadn't been legalized, it would have been, well, it was unethical. It was legal, but unethical. And some crossed the boundaries of legality also. So, very complex issues, and what do people understand about all these issues? Why should people vote if they have no idea what's going on? As I understood it, as I heard that in, when was it, 61, John F. Kennedy, 1961, or 62, became president, 61 I think it was. He narrowly defeated Richard Nixon, who later got his chance in the presidential election. And it was consider that he was able to defeat Nixon, although people had, there were a lot of reservations against Kennedy because he was a Catholic, and that was considered a disqualification. He was the first Catholic president of the United States, so people didn't want to vote in a Catholic. But it was, many people voted against him on those grounds alone, but it was understood that he narrowly got the vote because more women voted for him because he was young and good-looking compared to Nixon. And what's the grounds for voting a president? And then there was the slogan for Lyndon Johnson, all the way with LBJ. And that, on the basis of that, people were supposed to vote for him. And what is this democracy? I remember also as a child at school here in England, seeing the Daily Mirror on the election day for the parliament. And on the front page, it just had huge headlines. Go out and vote Labour. Why, who, what, when, where? So it may seem that it's being fair, but it's actually not a very good idea. For instance, you have a blockage in your pipes so that the water backs up in your kitchen sink, and you can't, just by putting this, what's that called, the plunger, you can't get it, and you put in some acid or whatever, and it's still blocked up. What do? You call a plumber, isn't it? Someone who's expert in dealing with such problems. He knows what he's doing. He's trained. You go around all the houses and take a vote. What should I do? Well, rather than having, you could call 2,000 people and take their opinion on what you should do to mend your bunged up pipes. You call one plumber, he'll look at it in 2 minutes and finish what to do. So that's a relatively simple function. But in the administration of the state, which is, especially in the modern age, has become extremely complex. So that no one can fully understand all the issues that are going on. But just to give everyone a vote, it's not a good idea. It's better to have people who are trained, who know what they're doing, and who are trained specifically for that. But actually, no one, we have in countries like Britain, the administrators, none of them have been trained to administrate. There's no training to be an MP, per se, or to be a local councillor. There's no training for it. People get the job, but they have to pick up the thread as they go along. Now, we may say, well, that's very dangerous because the power is concentrated in a few hands and power corrupts. So better have a system where you can take you can bring in different rulers and then pull them down. But that's also, there's serious problems with that. What we're finding now in the name of democracy, although there's no despot who's ruling, but we are being ruled by multinational corporations. The leaders, they have to do what the multinational corporations want. It's ruled by money. We don't even know who's pulling the strings. One devotee, I know, a member of this movement. He was for some time the personal secretary of one of the biggest businessmen in Britain and in the world, based in London. And he told me that this gentleman, who's the head of his mega companies, or collection of companies all over the world, he was on talking terms. He could phone up at any time, both the prime minister and the leader of the opposition, and he funded them both. And by the funding, he gets his work done, what he needs to be done. So, money rule. It's the rule of money. Democracy has some advantages over despotism, that's for sure. But the Vedic system is to train leaders who understand that I am in this position of leadership as a service to others. It's just one lifetime. By performing this service, I can become purified, spiritually elevated. But if I misuse it, I will have to suffer. The understanding that for every action, there is an opposite reaction. So if I do good work, I'll get a good result. If I do bad work, I'll get a bad result. Those who are in leadership positions, they have the opportunity to do great good and great harm also. So the Vedic system is, the system of polity is governed by brahmanas who understand that the whole purpose of society is to guide everyone gradually toward spiritual understanding, to get free from the cycle of birth and death. Not everyone may understand. Everyone will understand that to some extent, and even now, in countries where the understanding of reincarnation is central to the culture, which basically means wherever there are Hindus and Buddhists, and others also like Jains, but they're smaller. There's an underlying understanding that this life is not, even for persons who are Hindus or Buddhists and who are basically materialistic, but there's an understanding that we're on a journey and ultimately we have to become liberated from birth and death. So the brahmanas, they've taken such, it may be by birth also, but not only by birth, but whatever their whether by birth or having come to the position of a brahmana later, they're detached from this world. They're spiritually advanced. And they know that we have to guide society in such a way that everyone can gradually make spiritual advancement. Now, so for that purpose, society is divided. Another reason that society is divided, not only is it practical for different people to have different functions. Someone functions as an administrator, someone functions as a merchant, someone functions as a barber or whatever. Not only is it practical to train people in different ways, but also that is suitable for their present level of understanding. So there are different cultures and different rights and different obligations for different people. Some people have more what we nowadays we would call rights than others, but they also have more duties. In the modern age, we're very much concerned with rights and not very much with duties. But those who have, in Vedic culture, those who have more rights, they have more rights because it's understood that they will execute, that they'll utilize that freedom in a manner which is beneficial for others. They won't misuse that freedom. So they have more duties also. Those who have more rights have more duties. They're expected to act in an exemplary manner. So this is an overview of a very brief introduction to system of Vedic governance, which is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita by Krishna and is explained in other works also. There is the Arthashastra of that is compiled by Kautilya, otherwise known as Chanakya, which is taken from various Vedic sources. That is especially how to govern the state. There are many, many law books. There are different law books which have been compiled. They're called Dharma Shastras. They're being compiled for different communities in different places and different levels of the communities. So it's quite complex and not very easily understood. It doesn't impose a system of governance, the same system of governance on everyone everywhere. There may be a lot of devolution at local levels. Generally, the ideal should be there's an emperor and there are lower sub-kings in this way, right down to the local level. So that each village, to a large extent, can operate as a almost like a little republic. So that's a brief introduction, but it can be understood that the whole system of Vedic governance is based on the understanding that human life is meant for God realization. That is the basic point. And without that, then whatever system we have, it's going to devolve into hedonism, degradation, as we see at the present time. But that understanding of what is God realization, that should also be based on proper knowledge. Here in Britain, there's a very strong humanist and atheist propaganda or movement going on. And they have a point, as Marx stated, that religion is the opiate of the people. And it is. Religion can be misused. Of course, anything can be misused, but religion is very dangerous because people are willing to literally give their life for it. Of course, that's true of nationalism also. Millions of people in this country, starting from 1914, gave their lives for the dream of nationalism, for dying for our country. Anyway, religion, it's definitely a very dangerous force that if it's misused. So even before understanding the Vedic system of governance, we should come to the point, atato brahma jignasa, human life is meant for understanding what is the ultimate truth. Any system of governance, it's in place with a certain purpose. The purpose may be that there's a despotic leader who simply wants to crush all others and put all the power in his own hands or in the power of his friends and relatives. Or it may be with a more noble intent, just like the founding fathers of the United States. They made a constitution with the idea that everyone can live happily and peacefully theocracies, such as that which is just making its debut in Iraq and the Levant, the Islamic State, that is considered something very dangerous. And it can be very dangerous if, in the name of theocracy, there's no clear understanding of who is God and what is our relationship with Him. Certainly, that kind of theological system, which proposes that we are right and everyone else is wrong, and everyone else is wrong enough that they deserve to be killed for not being in our camp, that is certainly very dangerous. It works against the interest of the human race. So in the Vedic system, it is spiritually oriented, but it's also very tolerant in the sense that, it's often noted that Hinduism traditionally has been very tolerant, that everyone is free to pursue whatever religious bent they have, and they can be an atheist also. In Vedic society is also the atheistic stream, which is allowed. People are allowed to be atheists. It's not encouraged, but it's allowed. There's no question of chopping anyone's head off if they're an atheist or if they don't have the same theistic understanding that you do. So, on one hand, the Vedic culture, it's very controlled in many ways, and less opportunities for freedom in the sense that we worship in modern Western society. Everyone should be free, but there are many restrictions because the idea is that you shouldn't be free to degrade yourself. If we're free to a large extent to do what we like, but we don't know what is good for us, then we're going to do harm to ourselves. So certain activities, they are sinful, they produce bad karma, and they should be forbidden or restricted. Just like meat eating is allowed in Vedic culture, but it's restricted. It's understood that some people are going to eat meat. It's not a very good thing because slaughter of animals is sinful. But it's allowed, but under restriction, not that mass slaughter, mechanized slaughterhouses are there. It's understood that some people will take various forms of intoxication. This drinking of alcohol is a central point of European or Western civilization, but it's actually very harmful. The overall effect is very harmful in terms of, in the modern age, in terms of accidents on the roads caused by drinking alcohol and violence by people under the influence of alcohol, diseases. So it is allowed in Vedic culture, not encouraged, but it's allowed, but with some restriction, and not for everybody. People who are, just like the brahmanas, those who are spiritually advanced, for them, there's no question of taking alcohol. So there are many more restrictions than in present society. But on the understanding that certain restrictions are required because many people, they're not intelligent enough to act for their own benefit. That if we give them freedom, they'll misuse that, as we see at the present time. People have freedom, but they have no guidance as to how they should live their lives. And If we're frank about it, we can see that just like in Britain, although the people are very proud of their advanced civilization, but most people spend most of their life doing things that they don't want to do. They're in some job which they don't actually like, but they're just doing it because they need to get the money. So what is the value of such a civilization in which people spend most of their waking hours doing something which they don't actually want to do? Because just so they can get enough money to live. But actually, we can live, believe it or not, by cultivating food ourselves. Yeah. Where does food come from? From Tesco. Everyone knows that. But actually, you may be surprised to know that by the grace of God, food grows in the ground, and with a little effort, we can grow it. Not a massive. We don't need to make a massive effort this way, like as we have to, for instance, to get oil from under the sea, or from under the ground, in countries where they've got the oil. We want the oil. So we have to go there on some pretext and bomb them so we can control the oil supply. But believe it or not, it may be hard to understand, but for many thousands of years, people lived without oil. And it is possible also. And not only is it possible, but it's going to be probable, because the oil is going to run out at some point in time, and you can frick and frack and all this kind of thing and pollute the world even more than it's polluted today. But even then, the oil is going to finish. So Vedic culture recommends generally simplicity. Don't make life unnecessarily complex. What do we need to survive with the body? We need some food, clothing, shelter. For most people, sex is also required. These needs, by the grace of God, these can be fulfilled fairly easily in many parts of the world. Not in all parts of the world. In mountainous areas, it may be more difficult. In very cold areas, it may be very difficult. In desert areas. In England, yeah, the soil at least was good enough until they had some idea to improve it with some chemicals. Otherwise, in this green and pleasant land, food can grow. All kinds of food can grow. It's a bit tough with the cold weather, but not impossible. So simple. Don't make life unnecessarily complex. Now, the whole society now is extremely complex. So that for people to eat, you may sit down to eat your meal and there'll be the ingredients will come from all different parts of the world. So they take some oil out of the ground in one part of the world, take it to another part of the world, make some fertilizers and pesticides, and grow some food in another part of the world, and then send that to some another part of the world to feed some animals, and then slaughter them and send that meat to Milton Keynes. And it's all very, very complex. But it doesn't have to be. We can live very simply. Grow our own food locally. Live simply and cultivate higher consciousness. So simple living and high thinking. Whereas modern life is very, very complex living and no high thinking. There's no high thinking. People are not even, they have no idea that there is a purpose of life beyond the pursuit of happiness, defined as sensual enjoyment. So Hare Krishna, thank you for listening. And much, much, much more could be said, but it's just an overview. If we are to, if at all, people could become sane enough to understand that this whole society that we're living in is a total disaster, which physically, mentally, and especially spiritually is against the interests of all its members, including those who think that they are controlling it all and are on top of it. If we could understand this, then we could move toward a better society. This whole society is just killing everyone in every way. It's the fact that we have motor cars and we can drive here and there doesn't actually help us. And karmically, we're creating such bad karma by this exploitive civilization. Any questions, please? See if anyone else has some questions first. Yes, please.
Going back to when you were talking about schooling, do you think that this, the conditioning children now more than educating them? When you were talking about...
Do I think that they're conditioning children now more than educating? Well, education is... Every education is some kind of conditioning. Yeah. Education is for conditioning people to live in the present world that we live in. But that's true of any education. But then it's how children are educated and conditioned.
So in that case, learning Vedas is not an education?
Learning Vedas is education. Yeah. That's also a kind of conditioning. Children, they must be conditioned by the society they're in. But we just have to see what is the goal of this society, if it's actually beneficial or not.
Do we need a conditioning? Do we need a conditioning?
Do we need conditioning? Yes. Whether you, even if you say we don't need, but everyone will be conditioned, unless you're going to be alone, but then man is a social animal. We need to interact. Every society has some certain ethos or culture about it. There's this ridiculously idealistic idea in the modern Western world that, well, everyone has their own opinion and lives their life, they choose to live their life as they like, but as you pointed out, it's not true at all. The very idea that we have freedom to live as we like, that's also a kind of conditioning. Because in many societies it's understood that the individual is an integral part of the group, and individual interest has to be subordinated to that of the group interest. So the very idea that we're all individuals and we all choose to live our lives in the way that we choose, that's also one kind of conditioning. But actually we don't choose the way we choose. Just like the way you're dressed, you didn't particularly think about it. You just dressed like that because, well, everyone dresses like that, and that's the clothes that are available. So we're all conditioned in various ways. And if we pretend that we're not, it's just self-deception. That's all. But it's how we're conditioned, and we have to see what is the ultimate goal of life, and mold our lives and mold others' lives on the basis of that. The idea that, well, you just give children some basic education, let them choose what to do. It's nonsense, actually, because they are being conditioned. Even to give them the idea that they should choose what they want to do, that's also one kind of conditioning. You can't avoid it. Yes, please.
There is a propensity in England make sure that every child has a chance to go to the university. What you said earlier on, you either have the aptitude, the propensity, or education. Not everybody has got it. Is the British government wrong in that?
Is the British government wrong in giving everyone the chance to go to university? Before we get to the question of wrong or right, it seems to be self-defeating now more and more, because with so many universities, every little shack is a university nowadays. Every educational institution is called a university. With so many people getting degrees, there's no particular advantage to having a degree. Is the government... No, everyone should have the opportunity to develop as best they can, but it should be ascertained at an early age what they're actually fit for. That should be seen also, because the same thing, you can't make a donkey into a horse. And also, society doesn't require only highly educated people. Society requires many other kinds of people also. And there are also different kinds of skills that are required. So to be a good cook, for instance, you don't need a university. You need a different kind of education. There are all kinds of different things that have to be done in society. But everyone is just put through this stereotyped kind of education, which most people, whatever they do afterward, has what they spend years and years in school learning about it. It has no relevance to what they do later on. So it's a massive waste, actually, of human potential. A lot of what?
Dropouts. People who never complete the course. They go to the university after first year, second year.
They drop out, yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes, yeah.
School don't really recognize that they're conditioned to do really what they think is right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's compulsory education. You don't even get a choice. If you wanted to educate your children or raise them in a different way, of course you can do homeschooling, but it's still, you're being trained to become a cog in a preset machine of this whole society. Yes, please.
So, if the swamis are free from the material world, why do they have a salary?
If the swamis are free from the material world, why do they have a salary? Who are you referring to?
Swamis.
Which swamis? I'm a swami. I don't have a salary. Pujaris are paid.
The devotees
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, it's not supposed to be. They're supposed, but then brahmanas are supposed to live on the charity of others.
They don't.
Then that's not up to the proper standard, is it?
I'm just being.
You're talking about a particular polemic issue connected with the Hare Krishna movement. I'm talking about the ideals here. I don't know much about how the Hare Krishna movement in this movement is conducted, because I don't live in this country, even though I was born in this country. I have heard that there are complaints that the Hare Krishna movement in this country or some parts of it is highly commercialized. I don't know much about it because, like I say, I don't live in this country. I don't get involved in the way the movement's run here. But one thing we may say is that we're charging for prasadam. That's a standard thing. It has been in Indian culture, for at least at the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which was 500 years ago, it's described that there were it was a regular system for selling the prasad at Jagannath Puri. There may be also the consideration that if you don't charge, then people won't give as they're required to give. That may also be a consideration. Although charging should not be there, but then people should give as required. Anyway, I don't want to get into this because what's the point here? It's not going to make any difference anyway. If there are discrepancies in the way the Hare Krishna movement is being run in this country, then talking about it here isn't going to make the slightest bit of difference. And in fact, probably talking about it anywhere is not going to make the slightest bit of difference. Anyway. Yes, please. The Varna system in India, it's non-functional. Non-functional.
Not in Vedas.
In Shastra, it's definitely there. Bhagavad Gita. But the way it's going on nowadays is not... I mean, there are still some real brahmanas, so to speak, who are trained in Veda and all this. But there are very few, and most of them, after getting trained, they end up as... in England or America as computer engineers. I've seen, and I've several times, in Sri Rangam, which is one of the centers of Vedic culture up to the present day. Some years ago I was there and there was a young boy, maybe 25 years old. In India they're called boys at that age still. And although there were many, there was one festival there, of course in Sri Rangam there are more than 200 festivals a year, so almost every day is a festival. And this boy, he was beautifully reciting the Divya Prabandham, which is called the Tamil Veda. Even though there are older people there, he was chosen to do it because he recited it very nicely. So I happen to know one of his relatives, his uncle, Mama. And then after some time I asked, what's that boy doing now? He said, he's got a job in America. I said, why is he got a job in America? He's chanting so nicely. He said, well, you know, the temples are run by the government. The government doesn't give enough money to live. Your sister has to get married. So he's got a good brain and he's a computer engineer in America. So these are some of the problems. And I'll just tell a little anecdote with this. When he was in America, he was working as a computer engineer, going to work every day with his big Urdhvapundra, huge tilak, and big, huge shikha. Then he got reposted to Bangalore. And they told him, you can't have this here. So his only desire was to serve the Lord, but circumstances didn't permit it, which is maybe one reason why some charges are there also, because if we leave it up to the people up to the goodness of their heart, and they don't have enough goodness of heart, then the temple will go bankrupt.
So, I have been to a seminar where it said the Varna system in India is comparable to the class system in Britain.
Comparable, but not very much so. There used to be... come on, tissue there. Yeah, there used to be something like that in the feudal days. There was the king and then the noblemen. In France, there was what's called the third estate. That would be the religious people and then the lower nobility and this and that. And it was all by, and then there were the serfs and there were different, but. Somewhat comparable. All over the world, at one time, there was an understanding that we are meant for serving God. That's gone. It was misused. Monarchy was misused. The church misused its authority. People lost faith in it. But that it is misused doesn't mean we should dismantle the system. We should fix the system. Yeah, anything else, please? Yes, sir. Is there a point in time when this Vedic system is run as I described? Yes, it's described in Shastra, very famously, Ram Raja, the rule of Lord Ramachandra. Now, of course, people who are educated in the modern way don't believe in this, that Ram even existed. They say it's mythology. But we accept that he existed. Up until recently, Yudhishthira was ruling. Up and then Parikshit, Janamajaya, and then after that it declined. But yes, this system was going on. And when we say this system, it's the Varnashram system. We can say it's the best system, but it's not perfect, because it's the best system for managing a world which is imperfect. In this world, we all have kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsara, lust, greed, anger, pride, envy, illusion. So it's the best system, but we can't expect perfection because we're not perfect. But it's the best. All of these systems are meant to manage society in the best possible way. There are some ideas, anarchy. Anarchy won't work, because then someone who's more strong and powerful and is a complete jerk will come along and forcibly take power. That won't work. Non-violence, this idea, it's not going to work. As I've often given this example, if the government of India was to declare that now we have a policy of complete non-violence, we're going to follow Mahatma Gandhi, non-violence, and we're going to disband the army, and then that would what would happen would be that the capital of India would shift from Delhi to Islamabad in as little time as it took the Pakistanis, first of all, to awake from the shock and then send in their army and take it over. Because you can say non-violence, but there are people who they'll just take advantage. So it's required that there is violence, which is, or at least the threat of it, to contain those who will be violent in a demonic manner. Sorry?
An area or a country decided not to have an army.
Well, there are some countries without armies. Costa Rica doesn't have an army since 1940-something, but then they're run by the American Orange Company and things like that. So if they do have a problem, they rely on the American army. Well, not officially. They don't have an army. Switzerland? Yeah, they have. But Switzerland's interesting in as much as they don't have, it's a very different governmental system. They don't have one leader as such. There are other countries also, but that don't have armies, like Andorra and Liechtenstein and San Marino, but they're not really countries. I once went to the British Embassy in Ljubljana, in Slovenia, and there was a British Army guy there. I said, "What are you doing here in Slovenia?" He said, "We're training up the Slovenian troops."
So what does Slovenia have an army for? I mean, what is a country of that size going to do with? In Denmark, I saw years ago that one member of parliament proposed that we disband the army and we keep enough money in our defense account for a phone call to Moscow saying we surrender. Anyway, this is... It becomes very complex in the nuclear age, doesn't it? This world is deliberately created to be imperfect. Well, we made it because we are imperfect. It's made for us because we have illicit desires. So it's made for us to try to live out our illicit desires. Is that the time? 9:30? Is 9:25? Really? Oh, well, I guess we better finish.
Can we start serving?
Yes, start. It's already going on, prasadam service.
Yeah. So you can accept prasadam. There are plates of prasadam over there. But if you still have questions, you can. Sagar, do you have any
questions? Yeah, we can serve the prasadam and you can all munch away.
Yes, please. If you want to. Just behind you, if you can turn around.
Yeah, you have a question? Is there a concept of an economy in Vedic society? Well, not in the modern complex way, but definitely there is. The economy means the first requirement is what? Food. So that's described. Krishi go raksha vanijam vaisha karma svabhavajam. The vaishas, they produce food and any business they will do. And there's taxation. So, yeah, economy is there. You studying economics?
He wants to study psychology.
Yeah, you kind of feel that. Yeah. Meat eating is allowed, it's not encouraged. Some people are going to eat meat. So it's allowed. But not slaughterhouse meat. The animal has to be offered in sacrifice. Or you can take the dead body of an animal which has naturally died. It's allowed, but it's not encouraged. Okay, well, I guess I can take my argument.